You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's storytelling on the Moth Radio Hour. Among tonight's stories, rookie reporter Lewis Lapham learns a lot about the world when he has to break some bad news to a new widow. And boxer Jose Torres defines and then conquers fear. Tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, in fewer than 30 days, Donald Trump will be sworn in as President of the United States. In advance of President-elect Trump's inauguration, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has submitted a letter this week calling for the new Republican president to yield some federal power back to the states.
In the letter, Walker asks for more say in how and when refugees are settled in states like Wisconsin. He also calls on the future president to allow states to have more authority on issues like welfare reform and hunting federally protected animals like wolves.
Susan Johnson joins us now. She is an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Susan, in broad strokes, how would you characterize this letter and what Governor Walker is asking for?
Well, I think the letter is a political document, and I don't mean that in a negative sense. I mean that in the sense that the governor is trying to get some broad goals laid out there, so not so much necessarily in regard to each of these policies that he goes through, but he begins with this lesson, I would say, on the appropriate role of the federal government vis-a-vis the states, and talks a bit about federalism and the erosion of, in his mind, state power as it relates to the federal government's power. And it's something to put out there for public consumption. I guess it's important to understand, not so much that it was meant for Donald Trump to then begin ticking off on day one which of these particular items he was going to address.
In the opening lines of the letter, he calls for the federal government to be returned to a small, centralized body, he says, as the nation's founders intended. This has been a debate really throughout the nation's history, hasn't it?
Absolutely. It's one of those things that when you teach political science, that you talk about the recurring themes that come back over and over again. And absolutely, this idea of the appropriate role of the federal government vis-a-vis the states is something that was part of the founding documents and comes up continually over our American history.
Has President-elect Trump given any indication that this is something that he's behind, ceding more of that federal power back to the states?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at some of the things that Donald Trump has spoken about in regards to different types of policies, both economic policies and social policies, he's been, I would say, fairly consistent in the idea of the kinds of responsibilities that have maybe more historically been state responsibilities, being willing to consider that. And that's definitely something that is a core belief of the Republican Party today.
And looking at some particulars, Governor Walker mentioned flexibility on welfare reform. One of his hopes is to get a waiver to allow some level of drug testing of public assistance recipients. We've seen calls, I don't think this is in this letter in particular, but of federal block grants for health care, transportation, other items where, you know, federal money might come in with fewer strings attached. Is that the kind of thing we might see more of from a Republican Congress and a Republican president to sign off on it?
Well, right. I would think so. And when we have Republican Congress, we have the majority of governors being Republican, and we have a president, the president-elect, being Republican. I would think that we are going to see more calls from states, particularly those led by Republican governors. But to be fair, every governor, regardless of his or her political stripes, would like to be more powerful. And you even hear Democrats sometimes speaking about federal government mandates, although it's more likely to be heard from the Republicans. But I would expect that this is going to be something that we're going to hear consistently moving forward. It's not just Governor Walker and President-elect Trump, but it's also Speaker Ryan, who has been quite vocal in regards to, you mentioned health care, and talking about block grants and things like that.
And Republicans have said for a long time during the Obama administration that the federal government became more powerful during this time, that there was overreach at the federal level and the states got less power and the federal government stepped on its toes. Is there truth to that claim?
I would say, And I think that, generally speaking, this becomes a partisan issue, that both sides will argue that the president of the opposing party has taken on more administrative authority. And it's interesting because when President Obama ran for office, he talked about the overreach that his predecessor, George W. Bush, had taken in a number of ways. And what we see historically when we look at presidencies, particularly presidencies where you have a Congress that is dominated by the other party, is that when a president wants to enact policy change and he has few options doing it legislatively, you're often going to see the president act administratively. And so when President Obama had a Democratic minority in both houses in Congress, then what he had to do if he wanted to enact change was to do so administratively. What that does is it allows you to enact limited change, so it's not the same kind of change. It's not the long-lasting change that you can get by doing something through the legislative process, but it does allow you to enact policies when otherwise you wouldn't be able to.
Talking to Susan Johnson from UW-Whitewater, looking at state-federal government relations. Governor Walker sent a letter to President-elect Trump this week asking for more flexibility, more authority at the state level on a list of items. And Susan, I remember when Tommy Thompson was governor of Wisconsin, the phrase states are the laboratories of democracy used to float around, the idea being that with flexibility, without too many federal restrictions on what they do, states can come up with great new ideas, innovate, and then share those ideas with other states. On the positive side of state flexibility, is there something to that?
Oh, sure. And if we think about welfare reform, and speaking of Governor Thompson, mm-hmm. the first thing that comes to my mind in that regard is the W-2 program and the idea that that became a model almost, and so for the nation. And so there became this idea that states, it wasn't just with Tommy Thompson, but broadly, again, when we teach about federalism and the like, we speak about states being laboratories of democracy and policy, where ideas come up maybe more organically, and they're a way to try things out. I can also think of what we now know as Obamacare began as RomneyCare in Massachusetts. If we recall, that was the health care reform law that was passed in Massachusetts when Mitt Romney was governor, that then is very similar to what the Affordable Care Act became years later.
How might that power shift to the states, the flexibility you were just talking about, affect states when you're looking at an era where there's more model legislation that might be enacted in a number of states at the same time?
That's an interesting question. And I would think that when you have more consistency across states, because there are organizations that provide model legislation, I would think that it would even spur more, I guess, experimentation or more states getting on board with similar sorts of policies, which might then have more momentum moving up to the federal level to enact federal legislative change.
Now, on the negative side, people hear the phrase states' rights and think back to the Civil War. I mean, states without federal oversight allowed people to be sold, owned. After that, of course, states' rights was used as an excuse to prevent mostly African Americans from being able to vote and obtain other civil rights. Talk about the downside, potentially, of more authority going to states.
Well, I think that one of the things that people who advocate for having more national policy would argue is that it creates a greater likelihood of equality across states and for people within individual states who would not be subject to laws that perhaps would be discriminatory, as one example, building on what you spoke of. And also when you have policies that exist at the state level, you end up having a lot of difference, and that can create problems in and of itself. So, I mean, a lot of this has to do with what types of policies we're speaking about. And again, I keep going back to that idea that both parties speak to mandates, speak to these issues of states' rights and when the federal government is overreaching. And you really have to look at these things policy area by policy area, and then parse out where the partisanship is kind of woven through there.
Susan, I want to dig into the issues in the letter right now, and I want to start with the issue of refugee resettlement. It's an issue that's probably gotten the most attention from news organizations. What was Governor Walker asking for to Donald Trump in this letter?
In the letter, he asked that the federal government give the state of Wisconsin and states in general a greater role in determining the number of refugees a state receives, and in general, not just speaking of some of the groups we've been talking about recently, but which countries that we accept refugees from. There weren't a lot of specifics in the letter about, you know, point by point what he was asking for, but that's the broad idea that he was speaking about.
Susan Johnson is with us right now. She's an assistant professor of political science at UW-Whitewater, and we're talking about the balance of power between the states and the federal government after Governor Walker sent a letter to President-elect Donald Trump asking for more state authority on a variety of issues.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What did you think of the letter, the specific request the governor had on refugee resettlement, a hunting of gray wolves, drug testing for people receiving public assistance, and on the broader issues, how much authority do you think states should have as compared to the federal government on those and other issues? Do you think that the federal government has gotten too much authority now, or do you worry about the rise of more states' rights? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
We're continuing our conversation now about states' rights and the federal government. After Governor Walker sent a letter to President-elect Trump asking for states to have more authority in dealing with concerns, including refugee resettlement and welfare reform.
And we'd like you to join the conversation. What do you think about Governor Walker's call for more state authority? What role do you think the federal government could and should play under the Trump administration? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Susan Johnson stays with us. She's assistant professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. One issue not in that letter, but we could see a state-federal showdown. States, not including Wisconsin, Susan, have allowed the legal sale of marijuana, medical or even recreational. The attorney general nominee, Jeff Sessions, not a fan of marijuana. People are saying there's a chance that the non-enforcement of federal law in those states, well, that could go away. We could see big changes in pro-marijuana states.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just talking about that, in fact, today with one of my colleagues, because someone mentioned that that seemed like it's settled and the federal government has, you know, turned a blind eye. And to a certain degree, that's true, but that's very dependent on who's sitting in the White House, and maybe even more importantly, who's sitting in the Attorney General seat. And Jeff Sessions has been quite vocal historically in his not supporting legalized marijuana. And that's one of those situations where it really rests on the prerogative of what the federal government wants to do, because we had a series of states, even in just this past election, that legalized marijuana either medicinally or otherwise, and states have done that, municipalities have done that, but should the federal government determine that it is going to enforce the laws that are on the books regarding marijuana, then they could shut a lot of that stuff down. It's an interesting question. I'm curious to see how this unfolds.
Another area that came up in the letter was air quality. It sounds like Governor Walker asking to remove some rules about emissions. What did you see there?
Well, I think that that's fairly consistent with what we've seen from Governor Walker, and I would say Republican governors and Republicans in general, in terms of the issues of regulation as they relate not only to air quality and air pollution, but also to things like drilling and the pipeline issue that's been going on in Wisconsin, but also in other places, the Keystone Pipeline, what was going on in the Dakotas. And so I think that what we're going to be seeing are big pushes in that area to deregulate as it relates to environmental laws.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Ken is on the line with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Ken.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Yeah, I was just going to say about, I hear so much about state rights, and now when you have these model legislative groups like an ALEC, it's almost as if they function as a quasi-federal government. When you see the same legislation coming up, sometimes out of nowhere, and it's always something that's in front of 3, 4, 5 state houses, it really makes me concerned that that this is being done in, you know, back doors, but as a nationally coordinated thing. And so that's the first point I make. Second point I make is some of the state right things can lead to a race to the bottom, say environmentally. You know, if state next to you is passing easier environmental laws and you're losing business because of those, that forces you into a position where you have to do the same thing. So from that perspective, I see federal legislation better because it applies for a fair playing field across the board.
Ken, thanks a lot for that call. And Susan, let's take that second point first. That's interesting. The federal government could be setting a bar for states to avoid that kind of race to the bottom that Ken was talking about.
I think that perhaps Governor Walker or Republicans, if we're talking about environmental legislation, might turn that on its head, though, and say that overregulation is what harms business and economic interests, and what the caller might think is a race to the bottom in regard to environmental protections, someone on the other side might argue is an effort that would hurt a state in terms of its economic development. So I think if we're considering it from both sides, that's, I think, something to keep in mind.
And what about the caller's comments about model legislation acting as what he called a quasi-federal government?
Well, I think that's interesting. I don't know if it's a quasi-federal government, although I understand the point that he's making, that when you have a national interest group, essentially, in the case of ALEC, developing this model legislation and then encouraging legislators from different states to introduce that, you almost are having somewhat national policy being made, but it's still being made at the state level.
Thanks a lot for the call, Ken. We'll go next to Casey with us in Madison. Casey, hi.
Hi. My concern is that as states become very different from one another, if we have a lot of variety in state laws, we're going to have people who self-select where they live. For instance, I moved to Madison in 1995. Today, I would never move to Wisconsin. I would not have taken a job here. I would never move to North Carolina right now, no matter what kind of a job was offered to me. As more and more people who are able to self-select where they live move from state to state, depending on the individual state laws, are we going to find ourselves in a situation where there's more polarity than we already have in this country?
Casey, thanks for that call. And Susan, demographers have talked about a big sort going on already where we're voluntarily moving in with people more like us, politically, ethnically, economically, you name it. Is there a chance you think this could accelerate that kind of polarization?
Well, I mean, like you said, demographers are showing that we're seeing this happen. So I think that people are doing this self-selection, and especially people who are able to move. And so you have people who are able to take jobs in other places, move their families, and relocate. And definitely people are going where they see a policy environment that is perhaps more an economic environment, a policy environment that's more attuned to their beliefs. And so I think that that's definitely something to keep in mind. But I think it's a trend that we've already seen happening.
Casey, thanks a lot for the call. And we go next to David in Madison. David, hi.
Hi. I was calling in because I was concerned about adding a lot more power to the states, because I see that's what it slowly slips away to. Immigration and policies of people coming in the country, that's a broad country kind of aspect, I believe. Back in the 1860s, we fought a civil war because there was this struggle that was going on between the states and federal government, and we sort of settled it out at that point, saying, yes, the central government, the U.S. government is central to that. So as these other aspects that you talk about, I have a real concern that outside groups, interest groups will influence more and more because it's easier at a smaller level to do that. So I'm just not in favor of that.
David, thank you for that. And what do you say to David's concerns about outside groups having more luck influencing from the state level rather than getting a toehold at the federal level?
Well, sure. And if you look at policy change over the course of, let's say, the last decade or so, what we've seen is that states, and I would say particularly the Republicans, have been very, very, very successful in electorally and in terms of public policy, winning elections and enacting public policy at the state level that aligns with their goals. And so I would say that there's been a lot of policy change and that we could talk about that Republicans have been very successful in enacting at the state level, and that would be one of the reasons why the governor is sending a letter to the president-elect, because in a state like Wisconsin, where control of the legislature and the governorship is both of the same party, there would be a goal to enact more policy at the state level.
And we have to leave it there, Susan. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. She was with us to talk about the letter Governor Walker sent to President-elect Trump requesting states have more authority over laws and issues.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll explore the selected letters of Laura Ingalls Wilder.
For Food Friday, we go for something sweet and learn about how to get the most out of cooking with honey.
That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Tomorrow, Joy and her guests take a look at President-elect Donald Trump's $1 trillion infrastructure plan. It's tomorrow morning after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then a new report finds that inflation and health care costs have slowed significantly since the Affordable Care Act came along. We'll get the details. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.